So once again, welcome everyone, welcome. Some of you will probably be delighted to know that this is the last talk in this series. 20 talks. Thought it was a good place to stop, although I could go on. You have to stop somewhere. So the continuum that we're going to talk about tonight is from doing to non-doing. And it's really, I was thinking, you know, all of these continua have been about really shifting paradigms. Because the one side of the continuum establishes one particular way of perceiving the world and the paradigm that most of us live daily from. And the other side of the continuum is a complete shift of perception. And that movement, that journey between those two is really what the spiritual journey is and has been for us. But shifting paradigms is an extraordinary feat. I was trying to think of an analogy, and I thought of a poor one. And that's like digging up an old stump. If you've ever tried to do that, it's extremely difficult. It looks like I can just go out and just sort of hack around it and lift it up, but it's not like that at all. Because the root systems are very complex under that trunk. And there's often a main root system, and that's analogous to the sense of individual separation and separate existence that we feel. That's the main root system of the paradigm that we're in. But it's not the only root system, and there are a lot of auxiliary systems, roots, that form around it that are equally as troubling. And in fact, it takes a lot of time to free yourself from these different systems. Sorry, I'll just give you an example. Much of Buddhism, they talk about, you know, desire and fear, but those are just auxiliary. Those are auxiliary root systems, or pursuit of pleasure and avoidance of pain, or thought, our narrative that goes on endlessly, or time, or making objects of the world. You get a sense, I think, you know, how complex our paradigm of separation is. And what happens is that we sort of nibble on one of the root systems and we expect that to be transformative, but the pull of the other systems are so great that we fall back into the general way of our consensus reality, and we never come to a full completion of being able to dig up the tree trunk. And it takes a different set of determinants. It takes a sincerity and an honesty that needs to be fully resolved within each of us. You can't nibble at this thing. If you nibble at it, you will certainly improve your life. That's part of the nibbling pleasure of it, and you'll find some greater happiness in that. But the root system will be pretty much in place for the duration. Now, so given the fact that it really does take sort of digging on all sides of this trunk in order to free it, I thought one of the auxiliary roots called doing is a good place to focus tonight. Because doing, as you might have noticed in the sitting that we just had, always has a productivity to it. It's something, some way that it engages us and engages our thinking, engages our fears and desires, it engages our sense of time and distance, it engages the whole paradigm. And so it's useful to get a sense of what doing does to us. And it's rather interesting when we When we start exploring that, how fully the impact of doing is on our life. And then I'm going to look at how meditation is meant to offset that sense of doing a little later in the talk. But I want to also encourage the fact that, you know, we can only know one paradigm by observing it from another. So what we try to do early on when we're caught in the paradigm of separation is to develop enough quality of awareness that is really a component of the paradigm of non-separation, and be able to observe this paradigm of separation from this part of that we are exploring of awareness. And the awareness sees, because it is not tied to the paradigm of separation, it sees very specifically and objectively what the paradigm of separation is and what it does to us. The problem is that we include the awareness in the paradigm of separation. It's us being aware. And so it doesn't give us a full accommodation of what's happening within this paradigm, because we're claiming ownership of the very thing that could free us within the paradigm that we're trying to escape from. And that creates all kinds of complexity and all kinds of problems for us. It's because, we're not convinced that there's another paradigm which we can slip over to. We think we're stuck within what we have, and we might as well get on with it. And we hear a lot of Dharma speak, and we hear the prophets of old, but somehow in our life of certainty, our life of trust, we trust what we know, and we know separation. We don't trust what we don't know, and we're skeptical of all this sort of optional realities that we're talking about here. So it's a hard movement to have. But as this transformation begins to occur, where we are free more and more our sense of awareness from the sense of self that claims ownership of being aware, as that slips out of the bounds of that ownership, we begin to see more and more distinctly what that fixed paradigm looks like. And that is wisdom. You can talk about the Dharma. And it's not talking about it because you read about it, it's talking about it because you see it. You see it very clearly. And as you free yourself more and more, you talk about it in clearer and clearer reference terms. That's all it is. That's what separates any teacher from any first beginning student. It's just that slippage of where the awareness comes from. So tonight I want to talk about doing, and I want to talk about it in the beginning here is how it's so connected in essence with something that's fundamentally a part of our lives as we live it in this consensus paradigm, and that is productivity. You know, productivity means much more to us than just what we accomplish at work. It's tied intricately into our sense of self-worth and into our whole stance and perspective of our usefulness in life, our sense of meaning within life, and our whole sense of belonging to this life. Now, if you observed yourself in meditation, you would see that, you know, oftentimes productivity arises concurrent to a problem. And so your meditation may have revealed a certain confusion or conflict within you, and your mind suddenly moves into it in sort of an attack mode, try to figure out what that problem's resolution is. That's what I'm talking about, productivity. That engaged way that we look in order to move out, around, or through some obstacle that we have. The way to get over something, the way to get through something. And so And we do that virtually all day long. And it's tied very clearly to most of the ways that we sit in meditation. And I say to you that as long as we use the meditation for that purpose and with that intention, we stay very well fixed within the paradigm of separation. It cannot be otherwise. So, again, I'm not blaming anyone or scolding you, scolding any of us for that. But we need to know, and we each may decide that we're going to stay within the paradigm of separation for our entire existence. That's your decision. It's important, I think, for you to know that there's an alternative. Now, whether you choose it or not, that's again up to you, but to know there's an alternative, to know that there's a way to move our life that's free of this encumbered use and need to be productive and useful in the world in the way we define it, is an important escape in and of itself. And as I mentioned, that one attribute of productivity can free up pretty much the whole trunk of the tree, the whole stump of the tree, if we pursue it to its most refined root system. Now, so what do I mean by doing? Let's start very basically here. I don't mean detachment or passivity. I mean non-doing. Non-doing, I don't mean in any way being passive or being detached. Those are words that we often hear in relationship to meditation, but that has really nothing at all to do with meditation. I don't mean, obviously, stop working in terms of non-doing, and neither do I mean that we are to sit still and only meditate. In fact, it doesn't mean a decrease in activity at all. We can move very effortlessly from doing to non-doing and stay very much in the midst of our lives as we now live them. It's really a change of scenery. It's a change of perception. It's a change of the way we hold ourselves within that doing. And let me just talk a little bit about how we hold the doing that creates the problem. When we get engaged in life, we get engaged often through a goal. We see something that needs to be done, and then we start a productive action in accordance with that particular goal. The problem is that when we have a goal, it consumes and disengages us from the present. We have a book to write or a job to do or a problem to resolve. That becomes our focused center, not the present moment. And so when we disengage from the present, you can pretty much expect that you're going to have some difficulty along the way of your doing. Not only the tension that's built up from all the expectation of the accomplishment of your goal, but also the pain body that works well within each one of us rises to the surface. And that pain body is very instructive as to how it is that we hold our lives and how we perceive our lives. The pain body, whenever we have a goal, we have a measurement. And then when we measure something, how far we are from completing that goal, we're also measuring ourselves often in relationship to that measurement. How well am I doing in getting this resolved? And then the psychological pain issues just flood our psyche with how well am I doing? Are people going to like me, you know, if I'm late on this? And all of the sense of self-trauma that we have lived with from our childhood rolls forth through that particular goal setting. So we rarely have just a goal that we're trying to meet. If we had a goal, there's nothing wrong with a goal. In fact, we all have goals. A goal could be, you know, finding your car after the sitting tonight. Well, you can you can have that goal in mind, I'm going out to my car, and not let it consume you into some kind of altered state of pain where you're afraid that if you don't find it, what will people think of me if I wander around the parking lot or whatever you might... You know, you can have the idea that you know where the car is and walk to the car without any tension whatsoever. But most of us have goals in which the tension becomes the bearing fruit of the goal. And what we're really trying to resolve is the tension, not the goal, at some point. We're trying to resolve the inward pain that is accompanying from the task we've set ourselves. And we can't do it, because that we carry that inward pain along with us regardless of how we meet the goal. And no matter how well we meet the goal, it's not well enough. Not if the pain has the upper hand in our psyche, which it often does. Yeah? Have you ever had an evaluation, right? So I used to do these, I would be at a course, you know, 100 people, and they would have evaluations at the end of it. So, you know, 99 of them would be, oh, nice talks, he handles himself well or whatever. One would say, I don't like the guy, he's not. So 99 on this pile and one on this pile. Guess which one I believed? Which pile? Because it activated the pain body. And so the pain then took over. And it didn't matter whether the goal was met or not. What mattered was whether the pain body was settled. You see? So it becomes a very confusing psychological. Is it psychological? Is it, what am I doing here? It's like all kind of muddled as we try to walk ourselves through our life. We don't really know what we're doing or why we're doing it. We feel compelled to do it. We don't know, understand the mind well enough to be able to dissect the product of the goal that we're trying to accomplish in real terms to the pain of the unrelenting pain of our past. So some of this is why we have to clear some of this stuff up as we begin to dig up the trunk. We have to know what we're doing, or we just continue to move from one auxiliary route to another. You know, as we move in this direction, it activates this pain, which moves us back into that direction, and then we're back into it has to be clear as to what we're trying to accomplish here. And that's why I try to keep it very clear. You see, when we say we're moving towards quiet, to be quieter in ourselves, well, that's troubling enough. Because many of us don't want to be quiet. We get our energy, our fascination, our self-satisfaction from being noisy with ourselves, from having turbulence, from having drama, from having problems to resolve. Those tensions hold our sense of worthwhile, being worthwhile. And so to be quiet seems to take away the very birthing of our worthiness. And we're reluctant to do that. So why be quiet, you see? So there's, you got to start this thing somewhere. And instead of starting with the casting a doubt on the benefits of quiet, go into quiet and see what the doubts arouse around it, and start looking at the pain that's associated with those doubts. Because we're never going to get anywhere with anything unless we deal with the pain issues as they arise in relationship to the beginning of the movement along these continua. I've been giving 20 talks and I still don't know the plural of the word. Now I want to talk about meditation here, because it's just because I don't have a lot of time left to play around with it. So we're just going to talk about it here, right? It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And, you know, for some it's just a pause, a time to pause and be quiet and have a little respite time for the day. And then we pick ourselves up, and it's, you know, that's very useful. It's time out. It's a time out. And where we can put down the heavy burden of our lives, even though we often, most often, carry those burdens along with us within the meditation, it feels like we're getting away from life. It's a small vacation from our discomforts. Okay, so, and all of that has its effect on our immune system and, you know, all of that stuff, which is great. Healthy people and, you know, all that. But that's not really what meditation is. It's really changing paradigms. We're shifting paradigms. Meditation is stepping out of the paradigm we're in. We are plopping ourselves down and we're sitting still. And then that sitting still, this is what real meditation is. What we do within that is secondary. Real meditation is sitting down and just allowing ourselves to see what the activity is within us. So we step out of the doing, which is the engagement of the activity, trying to solve the problems, trying to arrange our life in ways that are helpful, to stepping out of the doing entirely. And perhaps you noticed that when you were sitting this evening, that stepping out of the engagement. Now what is that? See, what that does is that we are powerless in that moment. In the pure meditation time, we're not in control. We are powerless. We're completely impotent. That's true meditation. Because that's the paradigm, that's the shift of paradigm. We don't like it when we're powerless, so we engage ourselves within the frame of sitting still, back into the old paradigm and solve the problems and think about the thoughts and do all the things that we hear are not supposed to be the meditative process, but who's looking, right? So we'll just sneak our way through it. But really, this is a shift of paradigm. Meditation is the activity of shifting ourselves out of the entanglement of separation. Now, let me give you another example of that. When we sit down, what we access is an awareness that is not the content. All right? If we access the content, then we're going to be involved in checkers. We're going to be involved in trying to get the content to fit in the right place and jump the content that we don't like and promote the content that we do. So we're on some kind of a board game usually. Okay, if you just forget the content is not of your making. Now, where do I get that? Because from the paradigm of non-separation, whatever the mind brings forth is not your fault. In fact, it's not even your responsibility. This is just coming out of you. It is neurons firing. It's just cells doing their thing, communicating. And the expression of that is whatever conditioning we've had or accumulated in the past under certain conditions, this display of mind is what arises. Now we take that display of mind and we make something out of it. We identify with it. At that point, we are responsible for it. We have to be accountable. Once we've identified with the display of the mind, now we're accountable. We can't blame it on somebody else. We have to hold it, work with it, and if we're tied into it, we have to work with the pain issues that tie us into it until we can come to the place where we can just let it be. But there is an opportunity when it's coming up to let it go as it's arising. We are not, we have to see that we are not responsible for what the mind does. We are never responsible for what arises in the mind. Isn't that an amazing statement? It's absolutely true. Those are neurons firing. You ask to have a certain thought. You ask that a certain emotion arises. You don't even ask that your narrative be further expounded upon. But that's what's happening automatically, even in your sleep. And because we have learned how to identify our whole lives within this circuitry, we then claim our self-reference from that circuitry. That's not meditation. Meditation is letting it happen, just opening it up and just letting it out. Now, most of us aren't able to do that. And so we circulate, we recycle whatever it is that's coming now back into our self-descriptions and our images. And then, because there's pain within much of those images, we then blame what's coming out on what is external to us. And we create the external to us so that we'll have something to blame the pain upon. So you now serve a point for me, because I can say, you caused this, you made me angry. Now that keeps me, my pain, from being personally owned and accountable. And so as long as you hang out, I have somebody to hang my problems on. That's not meditation. So what we do as we learn how to meditate is first learn how to be accountable, so that we don't use whatever it is that's arising as a way to hook other people into our narrative, into our lives. And that's tremendously difficult if we haven't worked with the early childhood pain issues that were engendered in order not to feel the pain. So as this pain arises, and as it moves, our job, first and foremost, is to let go of it, to release it. Because, again, if we get caught in the content, then we're getting caught in the act of separation. Content isn't the same in non-separation, in the world of awareness, where awareness is the ruler, the Lord. Content is meaningless. It's meaningless. And each of us have within us the disposition to see from that level of meaninglessness. But because we're so used to reflecting upon ourselves and wanting the meaning out of the content, we keep engaging it in meaningful ways to keep ourselves useful, to keep ourselves meaningful, to keep ourselves productive, worthy. So we're reluctant to just let the mind be as it is. And so much of the meditation, much of our spiritual lives, is working with the contractions and the difficulties of what should be obvious to us at some point, as that this isn't mine to even have to worry about. In fact, it isn't even in real time. Norman Fisher and I, we were talking about this at dinner a few nights ago, where we were just mentioning that, the sense data sees, once it sees, it goes up the circuitry, the neurological circuitry, and then the whatever it is, I don't know what it is, some part of the brain, neurocortex or one of those, forms that into a meaningful picture. All the flashes of light or electrical impulses is made into a picture of what we know the world to be. The problem is that when we form that picture of what we know the world to be, that's milliseconds later than the actual data was received. It takes time to form that thing. And thought and all of that. And so we're actually seeing, as we're perceiving, we're seeing the past, not the present. And most of us don't know what the present looks like because we keep seeing the content, which is the past memory of what the present looks like to the neurocortex. And then we keep engaging the world as the past, just a couple of milliseconds or whatever amount of time later. And it fools us and it tricks us. And yet that's all it takes for us to have a sense of ourselves as being separated from life. You know, that sense of like life is happening to us? That's because of those couple of milliseconds difference between the arising of the present and the intellectual circuitry coming up with what consciousness is saying. Well, I don't want to keep looking out the rear view mirror of the car to drive forward. And I hope you don't either. And this requires, you see, at some point you get a sense that, whoa, you know, you really see what I'm saying in one way or another. It could be from different angles. This one was extremely important for me. Wow, I'm never seeing the present. And that rallies something in us, some quality that is not mental is evoked in that understanding. And now you're determined, except it's not you that are determined, it's the honest factor, honesty factor, the truth factor within us all, determines that it's not going to see in that way. And then it starts really moving into dislodging those patterns. Until we're just kind of sleepwalking a little bit, you know, do a little bit and we fall back and it hurts and we wake up to the hurt and then we do a little bit of adjusting so that the hurt isn't quite so bad. And we're just a little bit asleep in this thing. And it requires more from us than that. So meditation, I'm going to keep going on with this, strips us of our power. That's one of the reasons we don't like sitting. And another reason is that we have no control. When things are just coming out of us from whatever display the mind is working on, we're just allowing that to show itself without any without trying to manipulate it at all. This is the Buddha's third foundation of mindfulness that I just wrote a book on. And a very important component it is, where he says, just let the mind be what it is. Don't set it off by saying, I shouldn't be this way and I must be that way. Just this, just the display that's happening, that's all. Take all other forces off of it. Just clear it out. Now just see what's there as it's actually occurring. Now that gets you very quiet because the sounds we make are the disrupting influences we try to have on what we perceive is coming out of this thing. I don't like this, oh my God, what will she think of me and all. They're reactions to the display that's occurring. And you take that reaction out and it's very quiet. It's just this. Except I don't have any control. In fact, when you take out my reaction to what the display is, I'm not. I'm not off somewhere in a corner pouting because I have no control. I'm not in the picture. So you don't have to do something about yourself. All you have to do is eliminate the reactivity, the conflicts, that are intrinsic to oversighting having an oversight to your consciousness. Now it gets very quiet. But, like I mentioned, quietness isn't necessarily appreciated. We have to have done a lot of work before we can appreciate quietude. Quiet is what the study hall teacher kept telling us to do. Quiet was the finger being waved at us when we were in the library. Quiet doesn't hold a sense of self-reference. What value is it? What good is it? See, these are questions that each of us have to answer on our own. So when you sit down, when we sit down in meditation, my wife says, the first thing that comes up to me is I'm astounded. I said, I'm astounded at what's going on. What am I doing this? What's going on? What am I doing this for? I'm astounded that I will sit down and do nothing. Because those are the forces of productivity that are working on her, on all of us, not just her, to try to produce something, to make this time useful, to fix something, to think about something, to solve something. But not quiet. That's asking too much of me to be quiet. So all the things, all the ways that life is still important within the paradigm we live keeps us from quiet. All the ways that we still are needy in relationship to the paradigm of separation, that we haven't been understood, haven't been loved enough, that we don't feel worthy, whatever it is, the things we're trying to resolve throughout our activities, in our activities throughout the day, all of that. We're trying to untangle the knot of our own confusion. Secondly, meditation is meant to provide a receptive stance to what it is that's arising. And as soon as we step back and allow what it is that comes in to be seen, rather than acted upon, which is that leaning tendency toward forward, now we're already quiet. So in your meditation, see if you can just receive what is coming in. You're not like a cat. We're not like a cat at a mouse hole, ready to pounce on whatever it is that comes out. More like we're on the surface of water, and we're just watching fish jump. Just receiving whatever it is that's jumping out of the mind. But that's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do, as I mentioned. Although you can catch yourself in monitoring that through your relaxation. Because leaning into something is there's a tension involved. And receiving, there's no tension at all. So if you're just sitting back like you're listening, then you're watching the fish jump in the lake, but there's no tension in relationship to what is jumping. If you're leaning into it, then you're worried that something's going to jump that has some identifying impact upon you. So just get a sense of that sense of just receptivity. Now, this is important. Because the more receptive we are, the more we see. The more we lean into an object, the more the content is important to us and the less we see, because it's content focused. Our seeing closes around the content. The more receptive we are, the more spacious we are within the seeing, and the more we see, and this is key, the more we see, the more we understand. The more we understand, remembering from the earlier part of the talk, the less we're a part of the paradigm from which we are seeking the escape. And we're seeing from the alternative paradigm. If we're looking at content for our escape clause, changing this so that this won't be so ferocious and difficult the next time it comes up, we are caught within the same controlling content and the same controlling paradigm that we've always been in. But as we receive or release the need to focus in on each and individual expression and experience of ourself, the more we see, the more expansive the seeing, the less we're involved within that seeing, and the more we have shifted paradigms. The more we shift paradigms, the more we can see the paradigm of separation and what catches us. That's the way out. Exactly the opposite way that most of us involve ourselves in meditation, because we're using the rules of the paradigm of separation as a way to get out of the paradigm of separation, which doesn't make any sense at all. We have to use seeing as the escape clause. And so as we see, we get quiet. And as we get quiet, we're less pronounced. And as we are less pronounced, the paradigm shifts from separation to union. That's it. That's it. It's that simple. So if I'm willing to be quiet, if I'm willing to relax, if I'm willing to receive what's there, rather than to argue or resist what's arising, then the space from which I see will broaden on its own. It's not something I need to do, or I'm back in the content resistant mode. It all has to do with what is happening to us, not what we're doing to it. The less involved we are, the more things happen that are spiritually in line with the new paradigm. Now, sometimes I talk about quietude. Sometimes I talk about non-resistance. Sometimes I talk about receptivity. Sometimes I talk about releasing the argument. Sometimes I talk about the narrative and seeing the nonsense of the narrative. All of it has to do with the same thing. We're pointing the same finger. We're just using different, it's all being pointed, it's at the same thing. It's the shifting out of duplicity, struggle, conflict, argument. Into what? Into quiet. Into space. But space is not distant. It's alive. It's the seat of aliveness. It's not something foreign. It's just quiet in aliveness rather than noise in aliveness. That's all it is. That's all the difference. May it be so. Can we sit for a minute or two? So what do thoughts offer you? What do thoughts offer you that you don't already know? Why do they hold such fascination? Okay, if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to try to respond.
Quiet and cross into a different paradigm of being quiet, and if it makes the experience of it, if it's a more like a direct experience that doesn't seem like quiet, it doesn't seem like when you're saying get quiet, it seems like maybe I'm doing it wrong, or I'm just not sure. The experience seems a lot different than quiet, and if that's off.
So the question is around quiet and what real quiet is, as opposed to me trying to get quiet. Okay, so this isn't an effort. Noise is an effort. Noise is an exertion. It requires you to be noisy. To be quiet is a release, is a relaxation, actually. And the deeper you relax, you'll notice the quieter you become. Because the tension is what holds the noise. It's the struggle that holds the noise. So first get your line right, the direction you're going, a deeper sense of relaxation, of receptivity, of ease, and then naturally the mind will quiet down around that. But it's not quiet as opposed to noise. That's really on the same continuum. Sometimes you'll notice your mind is naturally quiet and doesn't have a lot to comment upon. Sometimes it's very noisy and has a lot to comment upon. So there's the shift of paradigms is really the shift from noise to stillness. Stillness is the space that holds the noise. It's not the lack of noise. It's not the loss of noise. Sometimes you'll find soon, if you haven't already, that you're able to hear yourself think. That which hears your thinking is not itself thinking. That's the space, that's the awareness that acknowledges that thoughts are occurring. Okay? That's the stillness that we're moving towards here. But we're never going to recognize that stillness, which is intrinsic, as long as we're noisy, because the noise doesn't allow the stillness. The noise is about the noise. It's about, as long as we're identified with what we're saying, it's about the argument that the noise is trying to settle, right? And as long as that, we're not going to recognize the space that holds that. So the first thing we need to do is to start. Well, there are a lot of things that we pointed at here. One is to realize that we don't settle anything through internal argument, and much of our narrative is not needed, and thoughts are kind of useless. And so we start put less investment in all of that. And as we invest less in that, guess what? The space around that begins to show itself. And it's a delight when we start living that space, not living in that space, because we are of that space. We are creatures of that space. That's our natural birthplace, is within that space. And so as we begin to abide in that space, we start questioning the need for further noise, because it seems useless, because it robs us of what we really want, which is that space of stillness. The space of stillness isn't lacking anything. It's total awareness. It's alive. It's the seat of life. It's like if you could point to the seat of life, where would you point? Would you point at your thoughts? Would you point at your emotions? Where would you point, you see? Well, I can point there. I can point right to the awareness, because that is where it is. That's what is alive. Everything else is conditioned, which means it's something we've learned within our aliveness. Right? So, okay, so if you want to be conditioned to the conditioning, that's how you just keep having arguments with yourself. But if you want to be alive to what you're saying, then you have to open the space up around what it is that's arising. And that's a very different formation of yourself. Now, what happens is that your perceptions change too. When you're lost in the words of the mind, in the arguments, in the language, in the narrative, you see life through those words. You see me and you, and why can't you get this straight, right? That's what you see. Okay, when you're not lost in that individual correspondence there, that doesn't make any sense to, first of all, it doesn't make any sense to argue, but secondly, why would I, you can just be who you want to be. You can be, I don't have to make you into who I want you to be. I don't have any preconceptions about how you should be, nor how I should be, because I'm quiet. I'm not even in the picture. And if I'm not in the picture, you're not in the picture either. Not as a separate thing from me. Are you following any of this? Oh, good. We're going a long way out there.
And it doesn't feel silent.
It doesn't always. It feels still. Okay. Okay. So I. Okay. So wait a minute. Come with me. Feels like that. It feels safe. Now you're thinking. Now you're not. You see, which one are you going to go to? Which side are you going to take? I got to think about this. Now, is he leading me down some kind of? I got to figure out this. I got to pull back into my 2 millisecond difference, and see what my gosh, I'm not. Okay, wait a second. Okay, I'll come. Okay, so there's a kind of trust here. But, you know, we're not going to trust. You shouldn't. You shouldn't just trust. You trust because you've proved to yourself it's safe. And after a number of ventures into stillness, you say, God, this is safe. It holds life. And guess what? It holds everything that you wanted. It holds love, it holds contentment, it holds all the things that we crave for ourselves but can't find within the speech we utter. So at some point it dawns on us that we're not going to be able to think our way into this. That's a huge insight. Huge! I can say that, and everybody goes, yeah. But I guarantee it's a huge insight to have. Whoa, I can't think my way into this. So now what? That's what. That's what. Question is about discernment. It's a really good one. A quality of this awareness, this space, is knowing. It doesn't lose its, the faculty of discernment is what gives us all of our decisions. It's that we just don't give credit to where they come from, and they're complicated. The awareness discerns, and then we add layers of conditioning upon all the discernment, and then we decide our path that has been long thought over, long after the moment has passed, and then we act upon it. So that's the covering of it all. But when you go right to the source of where creativity exists and spontaneity exists, It's within aliveness. So, and that's discerning. It knows not to walk across the street when a car is coming. It knows that. It doesn't have to rely upon, you know, a bunch of jumbled argument in order to be able to discern what's appropriate and what isn't. In fact, what you begin to do is live within what's appropriate. What's appropriate to do? It's discerned what's appropriate to do. Rather than to have a master plan, becomes very simple.
I just have a comment from my meditation, just the few minutes that you asked us to, and this is very helpful. Thank you. I'm working with something in my life that is really triggering the pain body big time. And I noticed sitting here, I was struck again with, the mind just does what it does. And to let it go. And I know that I move towards this particular issue and it hooks me, and I'm aware of it. Something shifted tonight. I can just intuitively feel it. And what shifted as I just watched it was I started, ironically, when I moved towards it, there's also a certain self-soothing that happens. And I was kind of surprised that that self-soothing was there. Almost aversive, or at least just distasteful. Like, I don't need to go there. And so that, just in those few moments when we're out there, I was really surprised at that.
We can disconnect from the pain body, and sudden moments of insight. For most of us, we have deeply embedded assumptions within us that we carry with us because we really believe those to be true about us, and they carry the pain body within them. Something's wrong with me. Okay? If we believe there's something wrong with us, then no matter how much insight you have into the fact that there's nothing wrong with you, unless it actually sees the falseness of that assumption as it's arising, that assumption will carry itself forth. Okay? So for most people, we have to go into the very root of that pain itself and explore it sufficiently so that the old conditioning that led to that assumption is extinguished. And that's the value. The fact is that extinguishment doesn't take as long as the conditioning did. Doesn't take as long for a rat to not hit the bar if it's not getting food as it did to learn to get the food and hit the bar to be fed. It hits it, it hits it, it hits it, no food's coming, to hell with the bar. Okay, so that's important to remind ourselves. We have to stop now for announcements, but we're going to continue this next week in the discussions. I hope people will come and further explore this topic. It's a good topic. Good topic. I hope I didn't lose you in my talk. It wasn't my intention to do that. But as the number of my talks left narrows, I feel like I'm want to get. Okay, come on, everybody. Let's get this thing. Okay, so yes, Barbara.